This is an ad by BetterHelp. What are your self-care non-negotiables? It's hard to make time for the things that keep you healthy, but being consistent with self-care is like working a muscle. And when life gets crazy, that muscle keeps you strong. Therapy is the ultimate self-care, and BetterHelp makes it easy to get started with affordable online sessions you can do from anywhere. Never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com today to get 10% off your first month.
And now, without further ado, let's begin.
Randall Smith was raised an only child in the small town of Pierceburg, Virginia. The townsfolk remembered his mother as a nice lady who kept to herself, earning a living in a laundry room at the Giles Memorial Hospital. But for some reason, for the first few years of his life, Randall's mother chose to dress him in girls' clothing. We can only speculate as to the effect this had on the young man, but what we do know is that his school classmates would later describe him as something of a loner, as well as a habitual liar. He often told tall tales of money he didn't have, or of spurious-sounding adventures he had been on. This led to his peers calling him LR, an acronym standing for Lying Randall. During his youth, Randall would often go walking the Appalachian Trail alone, finding solace in the rolling hills and deep primordial forests. After high school, Randall earned a living doing odd jobs around Virginia. Some might have fretted at the instability, but Randall relished it, as it gave him the freedom to ramble where he liked. And just like in his youth, he would spend the majority of his spare time wandering the Appalachian Trail, sometimes disappearing for days at a time. The trail stretches for just over 2,000 miles from Georgia to Maine and attracts thousands of hikers every single year, most of which see the trail as a kind of rite of passage for serious hill walkers. Most use the trail as a means of escaping their busy, workaday lives, taking comfort in the peace and serenity of nature. But at times, the trails are anything but serene, and there have been a number of hideously violent crimes committed in the area. Perhaps the most infamous being the 2008 abduction and murder of Meredith Emerson by a psychopathic drifter named Michael Hilton, which took place in a region known as Blood Mountain. During the spring of 1981, two 27-year-old social workers from Maine by the names of Susan Ramsey and Robert Mountford decided to hike through Appalachia to raise money for a mental illness charity. On their travels, they had made friends with another hiker on the trail, but had to part ways shortly afterward. However, they had agreed to meet up near Pierceburg, Randall Smith's hometown, to catch up and grab a bite to eat together. But when Susan and Robert failed to show up to the meeting, their hiker friend became concerned and contacted the police to report them missing. Deputy Sheriff Tom Lawson gathered up a handful of other deputies and then went up onto the trail to begin the search. On the way, they spoke to a number of other hikers, asking each if they had seen anyone fitting the missing couple's descriptions. Most said no, but one group said yes, reporting that they had seen a man and a woman talking with a rather strange-looking individual who seemed to be acting in a bizarre manner near the Wapiti shelter, a small log structure that had been constructed so that weary hikers could rest a while before continuing down the trail. The deputies headed straight for the shelter, finally reaching it on May 30th of 1981. By that time, it had been 11 days since the last sightings of the missing hikers, and unless they were experienced in bushcraft, the chance of them reappearing unharmed were rapidly dwindling. While searching the small wooden structure, one of the deputies noticed what appeared to be a blood stain on one of the floorboards. The men then fanned out, searching the area intensively until they came across a small clearing that contained a pile of leaves, one that looked like an attempt to cover something up. They kicked away the leaves, revealing a cloth sleeping bag that had a large, heavy mass inside of it. When they cut it open, they discovered it was the corpse of Susan Ramsey, the female half of the charity hiking couple. A day later, with the help of a sniffer dog, the body of Robert Mountford was found buried near a tree stump, also wrapped in his sleeping bag. Robert had a single bullet wound to his head, fired from a .22 caliber weapon, while Susan had been stabbed several times before being bludgeoned to death. Their bodies then dragged from the Wapiti shelter to the spots they were buried. Nearby, deputies found Susan's camera. They had hoped that the film might contain clues to who had murdered them, but found it had been pulled out and stolen. However, Susan's backpack was also found, a backpack which contained a paperback book that was taken for fingerprint analysis. Most of the prints obviously belonged to Susan, but one set belonged to someone else entirely. Investigators initially believed they belonged to Robert Mountford, but were shocked to find that they did in fact belong to none other than lying Randall Smith. The sheriff's deputies immediately traveled to Randall's home. He was not around, but the deputies had a search warrant and smashed their way into his place to make some seriously disturbing discoveries. Not only did they find bloody clothes and some items which evidently belonged to the murdered hikers, they also found a great deal of X-rated materials and, most disturbingly, some hospital instruments that had been apparently been fashioned into makeshift X-rated toys. Deputies also found a handwritten note stating that he had been kidnapped and was going to be executed, but analysis showed this had been written in Randall's own handwriting and was no doubt merely an attempt to throw the police off his scent. The race was on to find him before he could hurt anyone else. Days passed. The police had no luck in locating Randall Smith. All of his usual haunts reported that he had not been seen in days, with rangers and police scouring the Virginia section of the Appalachian Trail with absolutely nothing to show for it. The effort was exhausting, and Deputy Sheriff Tom Lawson found himself needing a break. So he took his family on a brief vacation down to Myrtle Beach in South Carolina. But in some bizarre twist of fate, Deputy Lawson ended up getting a call from the department back home, saying there had been an arrest in South Carolina of a man that was strongly suspected to be involved in the hikers' murders. An arrest in Myrtle Beach, of all places. Deputy Lawson hurried to check the suspect out. When he arrived, he was told that the arrested man claimed to have amnesia and could not remember his name or how he had ended up in Myrtle Beach, but that he was covered in insect bites in a way that was consistent with someone having hiked the Appalachian Trails for days on end. Insect bites that had been scratched so much that they were in danger of becoming infected. In order to get the man to reveal his identity, the deputies hatched a cunning scheme. They told the man that they could not get him the medical assistance he required without a medical consent form that he was required to sign. When given the form, the man scratched out a name onto the paper. Randall Lee Smith, he wrote. The police had found their man. Randall Smith was just 27 years old when he was extradited back to Virginia on charges of first-degree murder. At first, it seemed as if Randall would get the death penalty if convicted, but in a strange turn of events, he accepted a plea bargain that resulted in him getting a 30-year sentence instead of being executed. One of the victim's fathers was an Episcopalian minister who accepted the use of the plea bargain and was generally against the idea of Randall being executed. It was also thought that the plea bargain was the better option, seeing as there was a complete lack of motive in the killing, with prosecutors believing this would weaken their argument in the event of a trial. The resulting reduced sentence caused outrage among the local community and fury among hikers nationwide. Out of a 30-year sentence, Randall Smith only ended up serving 15 and was released in 1996 after reportedly being a model inmate who never caused any problems in prison. He walked out of prison a self-confessed murderer, but a free man, and returned to Pierisburg as a pariah. Randall lived with his mother until her death in the year 2000. After she passed, he became more and more of a recluse. although just like in days gone by, he spent much of his free time up in the Appalachian trails, and on more than one occasion was spotted chatting with hikers, who were no doubt completely unaware of who they were talking to. But even if they did know Randall Smith, the murderer, by his image, they may not have recognized him by now. By that time, he was 54, no longer the portly young man who had been convicted of killing Susan Ramsey and Robert Mountford. He was skinny, pale, and walked with a slight limp, and his time in prison had hardened what had once been boyish, smirking features. Then, in March of 2008, Randall seemed to give up on life entirely. He took all the pictures down from the walls of his mother's home, packed a few belongings, then walked off into the woods. He took only a few changes of clothes, some camping and fishing gear, and Bo, his dog. For all intents and purposes, to the people of Parrisburg, Randall Smith had dropped off the face of the earth there one day, totally vanishing the next. But to them, it was simply one less thing they had to worry about. So barely a peep was raised. A few months later, on May 6th, two fishermen named Scott Johnston and Sean Farmer were catching trout up near their favorite spot on a place called Brushy Mountain. It was a beautiful summer's day, perfect for outdoor activities and feeling a little closer to nature. All was peaceful and serene when suddenly they spotted something coming through the trees toward them. It was a middle-aged man with a slight stoop, one who warmly waved before approaching their campsite. The man introduced himself as Ricky Williams. Scott and Sean followed the unwritten code of Appalachia by inviting Ricky to sit and share a dinner of freshly caught fish. Ricky happily obliged, explaining that he was starving, that he had been in the woods for weeks by that point and hadn't eaten substantially in days. Scott and Sean could see this was no lie. Ricky was pale and skinny, and the dog that accompanied him was evidently equally hungry, with its ribs protruding from its fur. The campsite the three men had dinner at was only a mile and a half from the Wapiti shelter, the site of the hiker murders way back in 1981. As they ate, Scott and Sean asked Ricky about his life. Ricky replied that he was graduated top of his class from Virginia Tech University and had gone on to write highly advanced scientific papers for NASA pertaining to complex new methods of spaceflight. He also claimed to be extremely wealthy, owning multiple homes in Florida and South Carolina, where he would spend his time with his wife, who was a runner-up in several Miss USA pageants. Scott and Sean listened skeptically, recognizing that the man's appearance and his tall tales about a high-flying career were most likely a complete fabrication. To them, it was almost as if the man who sat before them was in a habit of lying. It came easy to him, like it was second nature. As the hours passed, the sun began to dip below the horizon. Scott and Sean began to wonder why their guest hadn't started to make a move back to his own campsite, which was apparently a few miles further upriver. One of them made a comment that he had better head back before the inky black of night had truly descended. Falling and injuring yourself on such a secluded stretch of the trail could mean real trouble for even the fittest young man, but death for an old-timer. Ricky stayed for about a half an hour longer before finding his feet, thanking Scott and Sean, and beckoning his dog to follow.
"Come on, Bo."
For the man's name was not, in fact, Ricky Williams. The man's name was Randall Lee Smith. And just as he began to walk away from the campsite of his generous fisherman hosts, he pulled a .22 weapon from his pocket and pulled the trigger four times. The first bullet struck Sean in the temple. The second shot slammed into Scott's neck. The men tried to run, but still the shots came. The third tore into Sean's chest cavity, while the fourth hit Scott in the rear of his neck. Blood poured from wounds caused by red-hot lead having ripped through their bodies. But still, the fishermen hurtled into the woods for safety. Scott had managed to find cover behind a tree as Sean reached his truck, parked in the grass just a few yards away. But as he climbed into the cab of the vehicle and slammed the door behind, he saw the face of Randall Smith through the window to his left. Randall raised his .22 weapon, pointed it at Sean's head, and once again pulled the trigger. But no shot rang out. The weapon hadn't fired. Randall Smith had run out of bullets. As their potential murderer began to reload the .22, Sean gunned the truck's engine and put the pedal to the metal, screeching towards a nearby road, with a bullet wound to his head. When he found the road, his headlights illuminated a figure standing in the middle of it. But it wasn't Randall Smith. It was his fishing buddy, Scott. He had survived his wounds, and had cut Sean off at the road in order to escape. Sean threw open the passenger door, and Scott dived in, still holding on to the open wound to his neck that leaked fresh blood onto the upholstery. But although they were in the process of escaping certain death, their chances of survival were horrifyingly slim. Scott was bleeding to death from a wound to the throat. Sean had been shot in the head. The nearest hospital was over 30 miles away, and they were driving on an uneven dirt road in the middle of near total darkness, their headlights the only thing to guide them, in woods so deep they had no cell phone reception whatsoever. And to top it all off, Scott had left his truck behind with the keys in the ignition. There was every chance that Randall Smith was following them, having tasted blood, looking to finish them off. It took just 5 minutes for Scott and Sean to find a house with lights on inside. But to them, those 5 minutes felt like an eternity. As they pulled up outside it, Scott leapt from the cab of the truck and began to hammer on the front door, screaming for whoever was inside to call 911. The homeowner, a woman named Melissa Miller, initially thought it might have been some kind of home invasion and was reluctant to actually answer the door. But when she did, she screamed for her 21-year-old son, Randy, to fetch some towels before calling 911. 20 minutes passed after the first 911 call, and still no ambulance had arrived. There was a pile of blood-soaked towels sitting in front of each wounded man when Scott asked to use the Miller's family phone to call his mother and father. He believed with all his heart that he would never see them again. But shortly afterward, an ambulance did arrive, and with it came a police officer. The EMTs tried to stabilize both men and ensure that neither would bleed to death in the Miller family home. But it was impossible, and they soon called for helicopter support to airlift both men to a hospital for emergency surgery. Scott, still bleeding from his neck wound, was loaded onto one of the medevac choppers, by that point convinced that he was going to die. He could think of no other reason for such drastic measures. His fishing buddy, Sean, had been shot in the head and chest, but it was he that was being airlifted. If his wounds were more serious than a straight-up headshot, he knew his chances of survival were bleak. As the helicopter took off, he felt his mouth filling with blood and heard one of the EMTs talking over the radio, saying she didn't think he was going to make it. He felt himself slipping away and said that at one point he thought he was already dead. But as the helicopter landed in nearby Roanoke and a blast of downdraft from the rotor blades hit him as he was unloaded, he knew he was still alive. Thanks to the swift actions of young Randy Miller, who had not only helped with fetching towels, but had also managed to get a hold of one of Randall Smith's missing posters, the police knew who the shooter was. Later that night, a Virginia State Trooper was driving along the road about 8 miles away from Parrisburg when he spotted Scott's stolen gray truck going in the opposite direction. The trooper turned in the road, turning on his lights, and the truck picked up speed dramatically in an attempt to evade him. But in the frenzied effort to escape justice, Randall Smith ran the truck off the road and flipped it upside down. The trooper pulled up alongside the overturned truck with his weapon drawn, while Smith was still strapped inside of it, the same .22 he tried to kill Scott and Sean with, lying on the ceiling of the truck cab, just out of reach. The trooper caught a glimpse of Randall's eyes with his flashlight, and later described them as the coldest he had ever seen. In a chilling twist of fate, the unconscious murderer was then taken to the very same hospital that Scott and Sean had been airlifted to. And when he awoke, tried to claim the shootings were in self-defense. When Randall was well enough to be transported, he was taken to the medical wing of the New River Valley Regional Jail in Dublin on May 9, 2008. Then a few days later, a jail officer went to give Randall his dinner, but when the crazed killer didn't retrieve his meal, the officer called his name once, then twice, but there was no answer. The officer rushed to unlock the cell door, finding Randall lying unconscious on the floor in front of him. Medical staff hurried to revive him, but their attempts were in vain. And shortly afterward, Randall Lee Smith was pronounced dead at the age of 54 years old. Forensic analysis showed there were no obvious signs of foul play, no marks on his body whatsoever, and in all likelihood, Randall had simply died of natural causes. So distraught at the prospect of spending more time in prison, so disappointed that his victims had survived the attack and deprived him of the thrill of killing, that he had simply given up on living. His funeral service lasted just 30 minutes, and to avoid any angry displays by the local townsfolk, the service was only announced after he was buried. Randall was buried next to his mother, while his dog Bo scratched in the dirt during the graveside ceremony. You may be pleased to hear that Bo has since been adopted and given a home with a loving, caring family who feed and walk him regularly. Perhaps the most terrifying thing about Randall Lee Smith is that it seems there were absolutely no motives to his murders. Scott and Sean could well have been the kindest people Randall had met in his entire life. Two people who shared food and warmth with a total stranger, owing him nothing, but giving nonetheless. In return, Randall tried to take everything from them in a sneak attack that changed both men's lives forever. It seems that Randall killed simply for the sake of killing, because it made him feel powerful. There was no rhyme or reason to his bloodlust, and not even those who were kind and generous to him were safe. Mankind has long fabricated beasts, demons, and malevolent spirits that have only ever been confined to the page or screen. An attempt at creating a kind of controllable fear, a simulation, one intended to distract us and comfort us, because the reality is much more terrifying. Real monsters walk among us, looking and sounding just like our friends, neighbors, and family. But they are not driven by love. And they are hungry.
Thank you for joining us on this captivating journey. If you found this exploration as enthralling as we did, please like, share, and subscribe.